Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Grunewald, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience in enhancing team dynamics and innovation. This week, Dane is joined by David Bainbridge, a leadership expert, executive coach, and facilitator with a rich background in engineering and leadership. David brings vast experience in building and leading high-performing teams. Listeners will tune in to hear David's approach to leadership and why he believes teamwork is more essential than ever. David will explain his philosophy of have a go, what's the best that could happen, and discuss the importance of embracing risks and innovation in leadership. Finally, he'll delve into why traditional leadership models are becoming inadequate in the post-COVID world. This episode is key for anyone looking to understand how progressive leadership can impact organizations and lead to breakthrough achievements. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team, put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Grunewald, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined from my hometown, Brisbane, Australia, by David Bainbridge. David is a leadership expert, executive coach, and facilitator. And coming from the world of engineering, we've been having a great pre-show conversation around what teams do around the world in these large process industry projects. So welcome, David.
Thanks, Dane, and thanks for having me on your podcast. I'm really looking forward to our chat. As you said, I've been in the mining industry for a lot of my career. I have an engineering background, and what's happened through my career is that I've spent a lot of my time in leadership roles and management roles and putting together large teams to do big projects. And while engineering's where I started, I didn't really spend much time doing technical engineering. I'm more spend most of the time sort of putting together teams and figuring out how to do things with people who are smarter and more experienced than me anyway. And so of my 25 years, I've probably spent 15 years in leadership and management roles. And then eventually I finished out my engineering career in an executive role for one of the large engineering firms and decided that I wanted to take my career in a different direction and focus really on leadership and teamwork and culture and that sort of thing, because I've always seen that that's where the true value lies. We can only do so much as individuals, and ultimately you need great leadership to create great teams and to get outcomes that you get performance that's greater than the sum of the parts. And I think for me, that really is the key to why I've done this. Over time, these sorts of things are applicable to all industries. So I also do work in the law and health industries, and it's very much people are people. So great technical people still need leaders to bring them all together to achieve great things. And that's where my business now focuses.
That's neat. And technical people will often get a bad rap for their interpersonal skills and team working skills, whether it's engineers or lawyers or accountants or doctors. So you're here to prove that is not the case.
Well, it's an unusual thing. I think I'm a bit of an unusual person in my industry, because most people get most of their success based on their technical abilities and their ability to be right and find solutions. But I think there's some people like myself who sort of have some engineering abilities, but ultimately I don't think I don't think I was ever going to be an amazing engineer per se. So there are a few people who really have to take on those leadership roles to make sure that everyone is working towards a common objective. And it is true that while there's so much need for leadership and so much need for a focus on teamwork is because the potential is there. But as you said, a lot of engineers and lawyers and accountants and healthcare professionals, they've all gotten to a point in their careers where they're very successful. And then they reach a horizon, and I like to think of it as an event horizon, where you tip over the edge and your technical skills no longer matter. And the trouble with that is that you've spent 20 plus years honing them to then suddenly get into a role where people say, that's not important anymore, someone else will deal with those technical issues. Your job now is to bring a large group of technical people together, some of whom potentially don't really enjoy working with others or don't have that innate desire to work with others, and get the best possible outcomes from that. And that's where I really focus, in that sort of that point where people are taking that one step beyond their technical competence and broadly entering an entire new world of skills and challenges. So I was fortunate. I started very early. And I think it's with everything. You can't be great at everything. So in my case, I've spent a lot of time in leadership management roles. And I actually had a very senior engineer pull me aside. He broadly said, look, you either have to get back on the tools and do some more serious engineering, or you're going to get left behind. For me, that was the breakover point of, well, I either go back to my calculator or I get good at something else. And it was a very experienced engineer. And he sort of said, look, you kind of have to make a decision here because you're going to become a bit of a no man's land person. You're not going to be a great engineer. And if you sort of keep your foot in both camps, you're also not going to be great at anything else.
Yeah.
So pick your poison. And I think that's something that not many people do. And I think I was fortunate to have someone who sort of, you know, I've had quite a few mentors over my career who have taken the time to give those sorts of insights, which have been very pivotal because I could have easily, you know, I was earning good money. I could have bumbled along for another 5 years, foot in both camps. And then I doubt we'd be having this conversation. I would have probably just run along and had a pretty mediocre career and it probably would have been fine. But those sort of little nudges that mentors have given me along the way have really been quite insightful and allow me to sort of design the path that I've taken.
I really like that. And a good friend of mine, Eric Enright, he talks about the invisible circle of leadership. So it kind of ties in with your event horizon. And the way he describes it is, as leaders, as you go through life, particularly around leading teams, there's always this kind of step into the unknown that you kind of have to take. And you do have to let go a bit and realize what it is that you are truly bringing to the team. I mean, some people really oversimplify leadership as, you know, if you hire and fire the right people, the team will do the work. But it's so much more than that, particularly when you've got a very broad team across a wide footprint for some of the projects like you've seen.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I think that for me, the hiring and firing is what I consider administration and management. So I agree with you that what I think happens is a lot of people look at leadership as a subset of management. I think that's a mistake because I really believe, and obviously with the field that I've chosen to work in now, I think it's a completely separate discipline. I think there are wonderful business administrators and managers out there, and potentially most of them could do it from a desk from their home without talking to anyone because you can run a very successful business by the numbers sitting in the back end collecting money. So I too think that people oversimplify leadership as being, well, I gave you the title and, you know, just make sure you're hiring the right people and hopefully it'll all work. And of course, as we know, hope is not really a good plan. So I actually think it's an entirely separate field.
I like that a lot. Before the show, you and I were talking about teams and you made a great statement. You said that the theme about teams that really excites me is that teams are able to achieve what should not be possible. So can you expand a little bit more on that?
I think early on in my career, you work with small teams. And if you're fortunate, you get outcomes that are sort of surprisingly good. You know, having been on some great teams early in my career and then having led teams, when we talked earlier, one of the things that we talked about is that I've worked on some huge projects in some very far off places. And even after doing it for more than a decade, it still is extraordinary to me that we can take a concept sitting in an office somewhere and bring together what appears to be an impossible jigsaw puzzle of pieces and people and money and risk and everything. And then a couple of years from now, we push a button and it all starts. And even sitting here often, I've been on quite a few projects that have come from, you know, as we talk about greenfields, but I've sat on projects that have come from desktop studies where someone's just thought, maybe we could do this. And when you first think of that, you think, God, what an impossible task, you know. And the example we talked about is at peak activity, some of these projects, you know, they have many, many thousands of people from all over the world with different languages. There's maybe, you know, hundreds of thousands of parts that come from all. And so when you sit in the office the first time and think, hey, maybe we could do this, it seems utterly impossible. And if it was your first time you ever did it, you would look at it and go, there's no way. But, you know, you have people that have, and in my case, you've got some experience, and you're like, no, I think if we get the right people and we're clear on what we want to achieve and we do a good job of understanding the risks, and I reckon we could make it happen. And from that point onwards, it becomes teamwork. You know, you get day one is where you go, I think we could. Day two is where you start having to build the team, because by day two, there's already so many things that you have to consider that it's impossible for a person to do it. And even when you've been in it for 12 months, you still look at it and go, gosh, are we going to do this? This is going to be mind-blowing. And then as you and I talked about, I used to fly to site and walk around, and I'd look around and go, it's phenomenal that all this stuff has come from all over the world, got a bunch of people together, bolted it all together, and it's just here. Every time I do it, it amazes me.
Yeah.
And that's where I think teamwork is, like, it's just not possible to achieve these things without great teamwork.
The example that you shared as well that really caught my eye was, and ear, was when you said, particularly with that big project in Peru, that you had to essentially build a township to be able to bring the people there and be ready to build the project. So this town was bigger than most, you know, rural towns in Australia. And a lot of people don't see that because these are remote facilities.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. When I first started out, my focus, you know, because I was an engineer, my focus was on the thing. So there's a patch of dirt that we have to dig up and we have to produce something valuable at the end of the day. And that's not a very people-centric view of the world, right? We get these bits and bobs and we put them together. But the human side of it is also quite amazing in terms of sustaining a workforce that's tens of thousands of people. And when you look across the really big projects, at peak they might have 5,000+ people literally on site. And when you're a long, long way from places, it means that you have a lot more people in transit as going around and transport and food and clothes. And what happens is that when you do these big remote projects, you almost build a project and you build in a small city. And when you think of it that way, it starts to become a really logistically challenging thing. You've got all your bits and bobs that come from everywhere, but then you have to go out and find thousands of people who broadly will be unskilled. Or if they are skilled, they'll be skilled in something that's not necessarily relevant to what you want. A lot of these countries that I've done projects in, people are happy to come with their families. So now you have this other logistical challenge of, well, what do we do with all these people that aren't working? And so when you think of the mine or the project that you're working on, it's the thing you're trying to achieve. But to achieve that, it's largely a humanistic enterprise of bringing all the people in, you know, training everybody up, making sure everyone's safe and well-skilled and can achieve what we're trying to achieve, health, well-being, feeding, clothing, bathing, ablutions, recreation, you know. So you end up building a small city. And in some cases, you end up building it and then taking it all away again. The number of people you need for construction is significantly less than you need for operation. That's never been my speciality until I started doing big projects. And then you realize that you need another whole team doing that. And so now you have the thing you're trying to achieve and then all of the logistical stuff you have to do to make it work. And so you almost run several other projects. It's sort of a different skill set to build an accommodation village than it is to build mine. So you take on these additional projects, and some of the really big projects have ports, power stations, linear infrastructure, roads, power lines, camps, mine, workshops, like full-scale workshops. So it's an entire city you build around these things at the end of the day.
It's fascinating. And when you touch on people bringing families, I know in Australia there's a lot of fly-in, fly-out, you know, camps, construction, operations. But once upon a time, Australia had a lot more residential mining townships. And I know that's true of other parts of the world. Do you see a material difference in what's happening in teams when people are actually in the community with their families versus kind of flying in, flying out?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of benefits to fly in, fly out. But overall, I miss The days of mining townships, I came into the mining industry when FIFO, fly in, fly out, was not really a thing. Cost of air travel has only recently become a really cost-effective way to do anything. Back in the day, there wasn't the infrastructure. There weren't airports and airstrips. There weren't that many operators that flew planes. So I came up in the industry before FIFO was really a thing. The introduction of FIFO has really led, in my opinion, to the death of the rural community that was surrounding these mines. And I think that has added challenges because you've taken what was a strong local community of people who worked there and their kids went to the same school and played in the sports team on the weekend. And so this very strong sense of resource industry, rural towns, and other industries spring up around that to support it because now you have families and you have little shops and you have weekends that people need recreational things and you have religion and sport, all sort of stuff. In Australia, that's quickly becoming a thing of the past. But actually in other countries, especially developing countries, it's still more traditional for people to go where the work is. So, you know, they would say, well, if I'm going to go and work at this mine in this other country, we're going to relocate. So there's a much greater, I think there's a much greater impact on local communities when the workforce actually comes and establishes a life in the region rather than just flies in and flies out. And some of the benefits are simply economics. If you work at the mine and then you live locally, you're going to spend a portion of that income locally. And so you get this regional generational uplift. If you fly everyone in, fly everyone out, then you really just develop a mining camp and everyone goes back. We see that a lot in Australia, right? People fly. I know people who regularly fly from New Zealand to work at the mines in Australia, and they get on a plane and fly over here. New Zealand's not that far away in the scheme of things for Australia. If you're going to get on a plane and fly from Brisbane to the Pilbara, which is the very northwestern side of Australia, well, New Zealand's only a couple extra hours in the plane. Well, it's four, but if you've been on the plane for five, it's not that big a deal. So I know FIFO workers that come in from New Zealand to work in Western Australia, and that never used to be a thing when I was in my early days in the industry.
Yeah, it is. It's really interesting to see that human connection play out in a good way in teams and then in a not so good way, because you've got workers that I would imagine are suffering with some fatigue and, you know, maybe not a lot of balance in their life when they're on site working long shifts. But it's an interesting dynamic for sure.
Yeah. I think it really increases the onus on leadership and team formation, because if you think of what used to happen, the support network of having everyone there and I'll say partners, but, you know, for a long time, it's more likely wives and girlfriends and kids. There's a community, which means you develop care, and with care comes that feeling of responsibility and accountability. In the absence of that, then I think the challenge really is that companies now have to go out of their way to ensure they're creating that. Whereas before it was, that was their life. They worked at the mine locally and their community was their community, which meant there was a personal relationship that had to exist within the community. Now, I think businesses have to go out of their way to create that. And even that's putting a lot of strain on the leadership team to create that environment that people need to be safe and perform well. So I think that now teamwork is more important than it was previously, because you don't have the underlying structure of society, relationships, and family. It tends to be that it's purely a work environment. And that's unusual. All of the supply chain, food, menu, like all that stuff. There. And that's there. So the overlay is high performance at work. So it's one part of the puzzle. But now with FIFO, it's the only part of the puzzle. Because when people get on a plane, they go away for days, they live their normal life and they don't think about work or any of their teammates. I think it's got a complexity that has really changed the way that work is done as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's also the flip side, which is that if the family's having a tough time at home, you know, a son or a daughter going through some anxious moments or something breaks in the house, then the worker on site feels a little bit helpless and detached because they can't be there for a special moment for a family. I know there's lots of industries where people are away from their family, including the military, for long periods of time, but that plays out too.
Yeah, and there's some very horrible statistics around mental health and suicide that have come out of the mining industry. There's a few reports that are going around about other non-desirable behaviours that have gone on remote workforces. And I think that's part of the symptoms of this underlying idea that you've picked up a bunch of people from all over the place, thrown them together in a very concentrated manner. They work long, long shifts. And fatigue tends to hit pretty hard towards the end of the shift. Then they all bundle themselves back on the plane and go home. And I think then that knock-on effect that you're talking about at home is also that person's coming back after maybe an exhausting 10 days work. And then they also not showing up at home as the person that they would aspire to be. So I think there is a complexity to all that.
Oh, for sure. Well, we went a long way down the mining sort of pathway, but I know you do a lot of work outside of mining. And what was appealing to me also in the lead up to the show, we were talking around technology and technology's impact on teamwork. I thought it was really cool the way that you shared that concept of, you know, collectively we are always right, and how that plays in terms of the human condition and ability versus the AI. So maybe you could expand on that a little bit, Dave.
Yeah, so this is one of those things that I think is a bit unique about my approach to leadership, is that I have this technical background and I really have an interest in data and the insights you can get from big data and how it can apply to A, people, but also how leaders could and should be using this to better themselves and their ability to lead highly diverse groups of people, right? And some of those insights can be in the data. And what I talked about before is that collectively we are always right, is this idea that groupthink, while it's generally not desirable, it's as a collective of people, we often, if everyone has their input, we often center around what is the true answer. And I described it before as being, you might not hit the bullseye, but you get so many points around it that you can infer where the bullseye is. So working with large teams and having lots of input sort of paints the picture, and within that picture is the truth. And you can't do that yourself. If you've got a bullseye and you get 100 people to throw darts, you can probably tell where the bullseye should be based on the distance that they all are from it. Whereas if there's only two of you and you throw, you know, where's the bullseye? So as teams, as we aspired to get smaller teams, we lose things in the process. And so I think with large teams, the more eyes you get on something and the more input you get, I think you have a better chance statistically of finding the right answer. And there's some really interesting research around that. The example around estimating the speed of a moving car, if you get 100 people to do it, on average, you probably actually have the right number, because the same number of people will estimate higher as those will estimate lower, and therefore the truth is in the middle. And that's a very humanistic thing, because it's that everyone's a little bit wrong in a different way shows you where the right answer is. That's not really the perspective that comes when you start dealing with AI. AI tends to look historically and tries to infer what would be happening. And the example I said is that if we asked AI, they would say, well, other cars statistically drive this speed, with not really much input as to what the car currently is doing. Because the current AI is really learning models, it can only really infer from the past. That's that 2020 hindsight thing. Yep. So if that car coming along the road is doing 15 Ks an hour because there was some extenuating circumstances, AI would still go, well, statistically it should be doing 50. And it would be completely irrelevant to the current circumstance. Whereas a human is not going to do that. They're not going to go, well, in my experience, it must be doing 50. So the idea that as a group, we can collectively use our perspectives, our upbringings, our cultural background to interpret these different things, when you have a large team, you kind of have that benefit of having all these different views and perspectives and experiences that lead to an interpretation of what's currently happening.
And I would imagine that that plays out really well when you run into a gap, a problem, a new challenge, because you can draw on a lot of people to say, well, this isn't lining up with this. How could we fix it? And everyone's got different views on what they've seen done before and why it might be the case, rather than one person sitting there scratching their head and burying themselves in a fix from the past.
Yeah. And that's really, as we talked about, that for me is this idea of bringing a team together, is that as a single person, you know, you have your own perspective and your own view and your own experience. And it's a very, very narrow view of the world, to be honest, you know.
Yeah.
And when you deal with new challenges, and one of the things we talked about is that these days we tackle a lot of new challenges, whether it's in mining, which is, of course, I've got a lot of experience, is that things that were previously unmineable or uneconomic, well, we have no choice now. And if you look at some of the numbers out there that are driving sustainability, they're very scary numbers. Like, we have to find more raw materials than we've ever found before. That introduces huge new challenges that no one has overcome. And in fact, previously people have said, this can't be done. But now actually the pivot is, well, there's no choice. And surprisingly, when there's no choice, people figure out how to do things. No one really knows. So you have to get all these different experience points. And eventually you're like, well, you've done some this way and some that way. And the South Africans do it this way and the Canadians do it that way. And the South Americans did this. And hey, you know, there's this thing in Eastern Europe that seems to work for some reason. And you get all these experience points. And you're like, so therefore the answer kind of has to be in amongst all that. And that's actually a really challenging thing for technical people to do, which brings me to the leadership piece again, because the team by themselves don't tend to move off into the unknown. They need someone to lead them there. And the more new challenges we try and tackle, the greater the impulse on leaders to be able to move in uncertainty, yet with some confidence and clarity around what the outcome should look like. And then, you know, create a great team to give you the best possible chance of getting there.
And I've seen this in a lot of teams that I've been a part of too, which is when you've got really bright people, sometimes they want to explore all of the assumptions before they start building the model. And sometimes you need to introduce the constraint. Well, guys, we've only got this many days or this many resources and we have to make this work. So with what we know, let's get started. And that's the bold role of a leader in a team, because otherwise each team member is going to be heavily attached to their own perspective, and they're driving more from fear of getting it wrong than from, hey, we've got to give it our best shot, have a go, which I think is a great Australian framework for getting stuck in.
Yeah. So I did a post the other day and it's have a go, what's the best that could happen?
Yeah.
And what I really love is that because I started my leadership journey really young, it's this easy acceptance of, geez, I don't know very much. I better get some people that know more than me. And then you get to see how people work, you know, engineers and lawyers and a lot of other technical people, doctors, surgeons, they're all naturally risk averse because the downside risk is quite high. I do it wrong, the person doesn't wake up. I do it wrong, it falls down. I do it wrong, we go bankrupt. There's all this, oh my God, we shouldn't start because all these bad things could happen. But that's the default, because if you don't start, then you just don't do anything. And when I say that there's a lot of challenges we haven't done before, there was always the first surgeon who operated on a brain tumor. Everyone's like, you can't mess with the brain. He did. It worked. Congratulations. We have a whole new field of study. You can't build things above 2,000 meters. Well, we did. It works. It's okay. There's a lot of challenges. You know, you discover things along the way, and then it becomes normal. And so it's always this leading into the unknown that creates the new normal. And as you said, sometimes it's about creating an environment that's safe, that's comfortable for people to take risks, knowing that the chance of failure is higher than what they're usually comfortable with. And for me, that is part of what is needed to create high-performing teams, because otherwise you get safe, mediocre outcomes. I did it like I did it last time, and therefore the outcome is reliable, which is Not bad, because, you know, that's how a bell curve works. Most people have to be doing the normal thing. But when you're talking about people who want to have high-performing teams or achieve extraordinary results, they have to be working in the tail. And in the tail, you're not sure which part of the tail you're in. And so your chance of failure goes up. Naturally, technical people have generally created the success in their career by not failing or by being
bad
or having their patients wake up after the operation. All very good things that you want most people to do. But to achieve unusually good outcomes and to overcome new challenges, you do have to be willing to fail. And the challenge there is making sure that you've got the right levels of experience and expertise around to mitigate the outcomes when you do, or help you avoid the truly catastrophic outcomes. And that's a difficult thing to do.
That's really tough. So if you're bringing a group together to tackle something which is hard, high percentage chance of failure, and it's not a simulation, you're actually putting some real world effort into something. So something could break and someone could get hurt or the environment could get damaged. I guess that's where it becomes important to have those control factors in, you know, someone in there from a safety perspective or an environmental perspective who's kind of watching but not leading. That's an interesting role, almost like a power of a stranger in the room.
That's actually, you landed on, that's exactly what it is. So I think what happens in normal scenarios is that you'll get together with a group of people and you'll talk about all the bad things that can happen. You know, like, what do we do with all these things? And it's a totally different mindset where you say, actually, let's just spend all our time talking about how well things could go, and then what can we do to maximize the chances of that happening, which is different from what can we do to minimize the chances of bad things happening. So fundamentally, what we talk about is what's important. And so if you're always like, well, how are we going to prevent this from happening? Then a lot of the efforts get aligned to prevention. And that doesn't achieve great outcomes. That just prevents bad outcomes. And what you do is if you flip that script and you go, well, the stranger in the room, so in my case, I call it the devil's advocate. I want that to flip over. I want the devil's advocate to just be the only person who's always Debbie Downer, the one who's like, yeah, but it could fall over. And you go, right, and you better make a very comprehensive list of that, and we'll get together for a specific session to address all these things. But we won't drag every meeting or every get-together or every bit of effort into preventing the downside, because then all we are is we're a team of people who are too scared to step outside the current way of doing things and the current way of thinking. So if you flip that over and you say, look, this one person, the stranger in the room, the empty chair in the board, there's quite a few theorems around this of how you game the system. But you say, right, your job is to be the person who thinks that the sky is falling. And then hopefully it's an acorn, but we need to spend some time specifically making sure that it is an acorn, but your job is to do that. And it's kind of handy. It's a bit hard on that person, but it is kind of handy to have someone who's actually keeping an eye on that as their only job. And then they organize specific meetings to address it rather than have every meeting dragged down. So for me, they're the things that a leader can do for the team to, I guess, artificially create an environment that feels safer than maybe it is. And that's interesting.
I like that.
That's like scuba diving's pretty dangerous. But you do things that sort of makes it feel safer. And so you take these things and you have to create psychological safety for people. As humans work, psychological safety feels more important than real safety.
Yeah.
Right? So you have physical well-being and you have mental well-being. And actually when people feel psychologically safe, they often do things that aren't very safe physically. So it's a duality of challenge, but in a design space, in a project space, it's really about making people feel like, I should take that risk and have someone else go, yeah, but you know, it's okay. We'll have that meeting. But for now, let's talk about how we could make that successful. And that mindset shift, I think, is key to developing that great team culture of being a bit bold and chasing down things that, as I said, are outcomes that would seem to be impossible, but you can really achieve them with a great team.
That's interesting what you touched on there as well around psychological safety and physical safety, perhaps going against each other in certain environments, because it's like the dark side of psychological safety. I'm really safe. Everyone trusts me. I can try this. And so I don't clip on my harness or whatever it might be. It's really interesting because when you think about how safety culture's evolved in a lot of work sites, it's been driven with a big stick, right? You know, you'll get written up, you'll lose your job, we'll stop work if you don't do it, which kind of takes away a little bit from psychological safety in some environments.
Yeah, I think mining is inherently unsafe, as is as sort of oil and gas, doing things that kind of bend the mind as to what you should be doing. And I think I've done quite a bit of work with mining companies around this, is that you want to find that balance of psychological safety with a focus on well-being and physical safety. And you want people to feel that it's really, really important. And the struggle with a compliance culture is that I do it because you make me, without that fundamental connection to the psychological element of safety, which is you should feel unsafe when you're about to do something that is physically unsafe. So you have to connect those two so that they overlap in a way that amplifies whether something is or is not safe. You see people doing things that I've done it 100 times, nothing happens to anyone. Statistically, the more times you do it and it doesn't happen, then more likely it's going to happen.
Coming
so
for
actually,
you.
As they feel more and more comfortable and more psychologically safe with doing this dangerous thing, they actually get closer and closer to the edge until that day when everything's fine until it isn't, is that problem of feeling safe when you're not, just because you haven't become a statistic yet.
Yeah, that the emotion of safety. I know I've worked with one great safety leader in the oil and gas industry, and he said it's a hazardous environment. So you should always walk into a facility, particularly an operating facility, knowing that it could kill you. But we've got great processes, protocols, procedures to keep you safe when you're in here, but never be complacent, never take it for granted. Always feel that little bit of fear underlying. Safety is a constant. It's never done. It's always a work in progress.
Yeah, one of the things I've heard that I really like, obviously I've worked in safety a lot, is having a healthy unease.
Yeah,
never like feeling too relaxed about anything when you're in. You know, it's like patting a crocodile. Always understand that you should have this healthy unease because it's not inherently safe. It's actually inherently hazardous.
That's probably a good way for teams to be too, and when they're venturing into the unknown, to have a healthy unease means that you don't take anything for granted. You lean in, you ask people for their opinions, you don't just go boldly forward.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. It'd be remiss of me not to touch on the coaching, David. So the types of coaching that you like to do, where is it that you're finding the most success with leaders right now? Because I'm hearing a lot. I'm hearing a lot of people that I'm personally investing in a coach. A lot more people that see that as an important and critical way to better manage themselves and better show up to lead their team. So what are you seeing out there?
Yeah, so it's been an interesting evolution of my business, because now I actually, specifically when I started my business, I really only did business to business. I really didn't plan to do any private work as such. And there are a few reasons for that, but also I sort of come from that professional white collar industry. So I think organizations should be investing in their leaders. Originally, I talked to people about that. But what I found interesting now is that I would say a third of my clients are private. And that's a surprise. Like I would never have headed out to try and build a B2C business, right? It's difficult in that scheme of things. And you would know that there are different challenges that come with personal clients. I've found it, because leadership is a soft skill, it's highly personal. And what I've found is that you can only get so far with generic off-the-shelf stuff. And what I often talk to leaders about is that leaders are unusual. They're not run-of-the-mill people, because they're people that have decided or have been pushed into roles that are uncomfortable, that are outside of the skills that they've spent most of their career developing. In some cases, they're a glutton for punishment, because you don't earn considerably more money You know, if you're a technical expert, you can earn probably just as much money as being any of the leadership roles. So it's not really about the money. So they're kind of a glutton for punishment. So they're unusual people. And when I say unusual, they're 2%ers, 1%ers. Like if you think of a CE or a C-suite or a GM or an MD, and you look at the number of them around the world, well, you know, if you look at the top 100 companies in the world, they have 100 CEOs. They probably employ hundreds of thousands of people. So they're the 0.000%ers. So they're an unusual bunch of people. And what that means is that they often have really good strength in some areas and really deep weaknesses in others. And they've found themselves in a position where now it's just not working. And they're not really sure why. So it's no point calling someone up and saying, oh, I just need another 6 months of generic leadership training. So what I've found is that high-performing, high-potential individuals are generally looking to people like me for coaching because it's really about working with what you've got, so meeting them where they are and finding the areas that they could lean into specifically as a person that would enhance their overall performance. And often the people that I work with are teetering on the edge of burnout. And the reason they're there is because doubling down doesn't really work. And one of my favorite sayings is, what got you here won't get you there. And I find that a lot of people who step into leadership roles, they just try to do a lot more of what was the recipe of their previous success. And it leads to significant burnout because they're dealing with demographics of people that they've never dealt with before. So other people at their tier or parts of the business that have come under their leadership that they're completely unfamiliar with. And they have a much greater exposure to the political environment of the board, the other C-suite, and that sort of thing. And it sort of works out that you probably were already running very, very hard to achieve the opportunity to become one of these high-end leaders. You're a high performer, you stand out from the crowd, someone's opened the door or offered you the seat at the table. So then what have you got left in the tank? Nothing. You sort of hit this point where I need to get better, but I don't know how. And I can see how I'm not getting the outcomes I need, but I'm just trying everything I already know and it's just not working. So I find that that's where coaching has come into its own and why so many of my clients have come to me privately, because they want something that's a mixture of exactly for them, and they want to be comfortable talking to someone about the nuance of what they think is not working. And that's also an uncomfortable conversation to have with your boss or your colleagues.
Yeah, it is.
And so I've found that I also do C-suite mentoring. And that's been that where people just like the outcome wasn't what they wanted and they want to talk it through with someone and figure out how they could do it differently and bounce some ideas off in a confidential manner. So that's a sliver of coaching where people want something outside of their reporting line and outside of their organization. In some ways, as a confidant, to say, look, I was really tight. I thought this was going to go great and it didn't. How could I do better next time? Well, you don't want to have that conversation necessarily with the people that trust you to lead the business. So sometimes being outside of the loop helps people be a bit more open and feel a bit more comfortable to sort of walk through what they see are their weaknesses.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it's interesting on there, it's just not working and people doubling down and driving the burnout. Because I think most leaders coming out of the pandemic showed back up to work to a whole lot of new stuff, you know, whether it was employee preferences, the burden on employees with what's going on at home, the changes in technology, supply chain disruption, you know, you name it. There was just so many different factors coming in. I think a lot of leaders kind of shouldered the burden to work their way through it. And it's not just leaders, you know, going down into middle management, everyone on the team suffering from sort of that overburdensome, that lots of work, lots of change, not a lot of time. So I think to your point on off-the-shelf learning, it has a place, but in a time of so much change, I think the intervention of a good coaching relationship certainly, you know, brings a little bit more immediate relief to the leader, but also immediate impact to the team.
Yeah, and I've found that in Australia anyway, you know, the employee conditions are good, you know, in terms of flexible work, in terms of remuneration. And so the challenge really is a very humanistic thing. And so the previous tools are with a very tight employment market in Australia, the previous tools around remuneration and flexible working,
yeah,
well, you've used up all of those tools, right?
So, good point.
You know, your tool bag's kind of empty. You've got flexible work now. You've got some semblance of balance, but people still need if anything, they need greater efficiencies out of people. And so then the leaders that have always been, well, I just talk about money and I talk about a bit more leave and I talk about a slight change in job space. It's like, well, okay, so if you've done all those things, what are you going to do next?
What next? Yeah.
And so that's a lot of the conversation that people sort of say, I've sort of shaken everything out of my tool bag. I've had a go with everything and I'm not getting anywhere. And yeah. I think that that challenge too is that it's a bit of a perfect storm, which it might be the same in the US. I'm not familiar with the demographics, but here it's the perfect storm of the workforce coming online now after finishing degrees remote, onboarding remote. And yeah. So a lot of the tools are completely irrelevant because the people that are coming on board are different. You know,
yeah.
They're sub-30s. Is a whole group of different people. And then, you know, you've got such a demographic spread, but the magnitude of change is huge. It's sort of that other transformation. We went from people with faxes to email, and then we went from, and then we sat there for 10 years, right? So all of the people that are in their late leadership positions, now they're dealing with a group of people who have never come to an office, who have never been in person. They did their degree remote. They were onboarded during the pandemic. And so now the traditional tools of leadership management are starting to become ineffective. And so that's where I think that bespoke leadership is coming into its own, because also some of the previous tools just don't apply to the new generations.
Yeah, it is. I love that empty toolbox analogy too, because it's so true. And there's some really cool techniques out there to, you know, put back in the toolbox, but they're the obvious things. Some of them are actually non-work items, you know, just getting teams together to solve problems and build some rapport, even though it's not actually a work problem. It's not pizza and ping pong, but it's still, you know, a more constructive team building environment. But there's plenty more out there.
Yeah, I think so. I think it comes down to, as you said before, that we talked about FIFO and there not being a community. So this is almost the same thing, is that, well, now if you're a remote worker and therefore you don't live in the city that everyone else is, you really are, the only interactions with anyone are specifically work. And when you're a hybrid worker or a remote worker, you know, it takes special effort on Teams to have a chat about the weekend or to it's another barrier to that organic building of community. And so I think we see that is now that what we talked about as being a FIFO problem before is also similar to how remote work is now, meaning that people are not becoming part of a community. They're just jumping online and doing the work thing. And then their real life continues when their screen turns off. And so I think it has similar challenges.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. We've covered some really good ground, David. I love the Have a Go. So if anyone is a listener and they haven't seen David's post on Have a Go and, you know, see what'll happen if it works out, that's a pretty strong concept. We talked a lot about the benefits of coaching for leaders in teams, the importance of leaders coming off that event horizon and really stepping their new roles. Just the breadth of leadership is, I really like the way that you framed that out there today too. And then obviously when we were talking about teams, building new stuff, achieving the impossible, I really also like the fact that you shared with us an intentionality of taking that devil's advocate or that empty seat and bringing them in a disciplined way rather than having that loss aversion dragged through every meeting, because that it speeds up teams for what they can achieve. So lots of good insights from your experiences. And if any of our listeners want to find you or do some work with, how do they best find you?
Best way to find me is on LinkedIn. I'm on there pretty frequently, and I'm happy if someone connects or sends me a message. That's the best way, I think. And if anyone just has questions, I think this topic is something that's I'm passionate about. I love talking about. So, if anyone's interested in continuing this chat offline, we can have a discussion on LinkedIn.
Sounds good. Well, thanks again for taking the time today, David.
Thanks, Dane. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,